Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm honored to have as my guest Louise Erdrich, who is talking to me from the NPR studios in Manhattan. She's the author, most recently, of The Master Butcher's Singing Club, published by HarperCollins. But you have probably been following many of these people, at least these settings, in her earlier novels, which include Love Medicine, The Beat Queen, Tracks, The Bingo Palace, Tales of Burning Love, The Antelope Wife, and The Last Report on the Miracles at Little No Horse. This book is set largely in Argus, North Dakota, and it is concerned with the German ancestry of Louise's family. Louise is a mixed background. Her mother is Ojibwe and French. Her father is German-American. And this is, I believe, the first book to focus on the German background of the family. Did it provide any special difficulties, Louise?
Hi, and I'm so glad to be talking to you. Did it present special difficulties? I didn't really feel as though I was making some sort of departure. I guess when you're, when because I grow up, I've grown up being this one person, I've been able to switch back and forth between one side or another of my backgrounds. And the only difficulties it provided, I suppose, were that the technical difficulties of researching what took place during World War One, World War Two. Some of the other difficulties were figuring out how to prepare sausages. Thankfully, my father was able to provide some relief there. He read the book and told me a thing or two. That's his father on the cover of the book, the young man standing there so proudly with his sharpening steel at his side.
Now, I often find that your epigraphs bear an unusual relationship to the text. This one is a German song, and much of the book, The Butchers, The Master Butchers Singing Club, is the title of the book, but there's a certain sense in which song, and the song of things as well, provide a context for the book. I wondered first if you could tell me the epigraph and what it means.
In your book, it's different from what it is in my book, actually.
But is that so?
It is Die Gedanken sind frei is the first song. You have the reading copy, and then there's with it, there's a Lakota ghost dance song. And I put the songs resonate throughout the book, and in fact come together at the end. I think that Die Gedanken sind frei, it's one of the most fascinating of German songs to me. My father used to sing it to me. The book is dedicated to him, and he would sing to me on the way to church, and often when we were just on car trips. And that particular song, I grew up speaking, or at least understanding German. It says a lot about how your thoughts are free, how nobody can know your thoughts, how they're like shadows in the night, how no one can hunt them down, no one can take these thoughts away from you. And I thought, in the context of the book and in the context of the war, and especially in the context of World War II, what did those words mean? I mean, that song for me was so emblematic of what it meant to be German as a child, but as I learned more about history, it became almost ironic to me and almost a painful song to contemplate.
And tell me about the ghost dance song.
At the end, one of the characters, who is Ojibwe, remembers back into her childhood and remembers being part of an Ojibwe exploratory group who went down to learn about the ghost dance. And in reading about ghost dancers and so the oral history of Wounded Knee, I learned that there were some Cree or Ojibwe people who were actually there. And that really haunted me, and I asked around. I asked some elders and people who know the oral history from the Ojibwe side, and they said indeed that there had been people who went down to learn about this new, it was a messianic kind of religion, but it had to do a lot with coming into contact and singing the dead back into being. And that reoccurs throughout the book, this notion of song being a force that is almost in the air around us and never quite disappears, and that all songs merge into something that we can't name. And in fact, in Ojibwe theology, it's sometimes said that the songs invent us rather than us inventing the songs.
Mm. Now, Delphine, who is the heroine of the novel, is someone who we learn does not know who she is. It takes us a while to learn this, and gradually, as we do, we learn that the book is about the meeting of cultures in a way that it doesn't first appear to be. This seems at first to be a German-American community, and the idea of no one can know your thoughts is a kind of metaphysical idea, but gradually we see that these people do not and cannot know each other. There are blocks between them emotionally, sexually, by heritage, by tradition, and there's even the sense that the gossip of the Argus community is only a destructive gossip, changing people's stature in the community, but never providing what gossip can also do, a feeling of continuity, of context, mm-hmm. of people knowing one another. And I particularly wondered, because this book seems almost to be about the way in which these people can unite in song, but other kinds of unity are unavailable.
Oh, I think that's very true. The song, oddly in a way, gives people in a small town, very much like the town I grew up in, a way to be emotionally expressive, a permissible way to express emotion, a permissible way to almost jump out of your skin. You know, but there are very few ways in a small town where that can be done without you being marked out as odd, strange, as Delphine is marked out as someone who isn't of the sort of self-proclaimed upper crust of the town, you know, and these striations and these hierarchies are so much part of small town life, and everyone really knows their exact place in the social order of a town of this sort. And Delphine knows from the very beginning that because her father is a souse and she hasn't a mother, and that she really doesn't know who she is, that she's among, you know, the lower orders, including as those who live lightly upon the earth, the very poor.
Now, she comes back to Argus at the beginning of the book. She has been traveling in a balancing act with a rather remarkable character named Cyprian Lazar. And Cyprian likes other men, although they live together more or less as husband and wife, which is a relationship sort of like brother and sister. And that feeling Delphine seems to be searching for, of a passion that will connect her to another person is as frightening to her as it is desirable. And the book, in many cases, is about the way in which these people have domesticated, carefully handled extreme passion.
Mm-hmm.
Cyprian is even willing, he tells her, for the sake of their rather beautiful stability, to sacrifice his love for men in order to be with her. But always there's the sense that someone is going to have to give something up, and that balance becomes the internal theme of this book, and what you pay for balance.
Exactly true. At the sacrifice of his passions and her passions. It's as though they can't imagine having a happiness that includes both stability and some form of passion.
I'm speaking to Louise Erdrich, the author most recently of The Master Butcher's Singing Club. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, in this book, it seems as if there are a series of almost transpositions. Delphine is going to supplant her dear friend Eva and become the butcher's wife after Eva's death. A boy is going to be reborn out of the earth of a collapsed tunnel. There's a whole sense that whoever you love, there has been a missing original. Delphine's father, it turns out, has spent his entire life loving a somewhat imaginary person. I wondered why, in this book, the ways of love are so indirect.
I find that those words you used, a missing original, to be so resonant for me. In fact, I think it's part of almost every book, this idea that there is some, a missing original. Is it a missing twin? Is it some, is it that platonic idea of the entwined wheel of the genders, and, you know, how we will always miss that other half of our being? I don't know, and it's something I think I explore over and over. This sense of longing for some form of union. Sometimes it is, it becomes transcendent, it becomes religious. Often it's a longing for the mother, which is very much part of Delphine's longing.
What I have been sensing in these last couple of books, Louise, is a very magnificent kind of sustained singing about the lost or the held off or the forgotten or the forbidden. And I wonder if you feel it as a writer the way I feel it as a reader, that something that has not been said before, has not been said easily, is going right in this book. Does it contain an elation for you as you're composing?
It does. You know, I feel as though Isaac Dinesen once said that as a woman goes, you know, I'm now 40, I'll be 49 soon, and I feel as though maturing has been wonderful for me, because I've been able to put away so many expectations that are burdens for younger women to bear. And, you know, I said something about feeling authentic. And I think you're talking about voice and about singing. And I think more and more that I feel that when I write, it's coming from the most authentic part of who I am. And that I'm yearning and writing towards some sort of unity that, for me, in speaking of the books and the art, has to do with some unfinished vision that I have of all these books being one larger, grander book than I could ever tell alone. You know, I need many books to work on and complete it. And it's occurred to me how comforting it is to have this as a life's work and to know what I'm working toward.
Now, one of the things that thrilled me about The Master Butcher's Singing Club by my guest Louise Erdrich is that at first it seems as if the book is going to pivot around the solution to a mystery. When Delphine comes home, her alcoholic father has allowed chaos to build up. There's a fabulously described stink of everything that is uncleaned. It may seem as if the house has to be burned down in order for the stink to be eliminated, and smells, particularly stenches in this book, are going to be very important. There have been people, a family, a husband, a wife, and their daughter, who have been trapped in the cellar. They have come to Roy's house for a wake. They have gone down to the cellar to look for more alcohol, presumably, but they've been caught down there, suffocating, while Roy, drinking crazily, cannot hear them. And yet the swill and junk and dog poop and everything have sealed the trap door. There's a suggestion, though, that there's some foul play involved. And it's almost as if midway through the novel, you decide, no, we're not going to solve this mystery. We're going to let there be another murder and an escape. And in fact, the person who will be murdered will be the detective. But it's as if the book decides it doesn't want the burden of all the way through. And in many lives in the Master Butcher's Singing Club, suddenly still be with the book. There's a sense in which in the second one finds another have been laid down, are suddenly suspended or held, as they say, in the balance.
I sort of hesitate to say sometimes the book takes over and surprises you, because I know a lot of writers say that, but I didn't know what was literally in the basement. You know, I was writing these scenes, and I think they're more almost symbolic than mm-hmm. There's something very terrible that Delphine can't ignore, and it keeps coming up at her from underneath. She keeps, in fact, seeing the dream-like images of these pathetic ghosts in her cellar, these, you know, unbidden urges, these strange, horrible flowers that have developed in the cellar of the house. You know, it's very much a kind of symbolic evil, almost, that she can't ignore and she can't solve. And it didn't seem right to me as I went along through the book to make it into a murder mystery, because it really wasn't a mystery. It was it was something that wasn't really meant to be solved. It was a terrible thing that was going to haunt Delphine and still does haunt her into the end of the book.
Well, it's as if the inner subject of the book is interrupted acts of inappropriate passion, and mm-hmm. that these, I don't know how to say this directly, but it's almost as if, as I was reading, began to understand that Louise Erdrich was saying that while these people can gather together in song, they have no inner community. And mm-hmm. I began to think that this book is meant to stand in contrast to the others, where communities are held together by all kinds of heart ties. Here, it's always this sense of people whose real home is in Germany. Children are sent back home to be raised there, violating the most basic connection of parent and child. And over again, there's this strange sense that life has to be almost aborted in order for these desires to fulfill themselves.
I'm so glad that you've thought about this, because I see it too, and I hadn't really thought of it that way before, but this really is a book about tremendous isolation and loneliness in contrast to the more and longing for order and rigidity, in contrast to the more messy but, as you said, heart-connected communities of the other books. And I hadn't thought of that before.
Well, it seemed as if the part of your family that is German, who you dearly love, is nevertheless representative of a different kind of order, more hierarchical, more gender-decided, or at least more punishing of indecisive gender, more based upon silence and strange shared looks. When Delphine sees the butcher for the first time, is it Fidelis?
Yes.
There's genuinely a tremble in the ground, which is something that seems to happen in American literature post-Hemingway.
Post-Hemingway,
yes.
It does a lot.
I'm sorry, but it
no,
does.
It does.
Yet that tremor is the only, it will not be actualized. The level of passion that is instinctive between them becomes a trained passion. And Delphine instructs the butcher not to put his head between her legs, not to feel there. She won't be able to sustain it. No. And there's that extraordinary sense of restraint, of training, of holding back in this book, which I think makes it kind of remarkable, especially when placed against the thick contexts of the other novels you've written.
Well, I think that the title says it as well. You know, the master butchers are, of course, very proud of their training. I mean, it's an exclusive kind of and lengthy and arduous sort of training that they go through. So, but there they are with a singing club, and there's a kind of absurdity to it as well. And I think that, you know, part of what I wanted to do in the book was undercut some of that sense of pride in rigidity and pride in order. And, you know, the aunt, Tanta, who is so afraid of the opinions of others. You know, it's something, of course, that, as I said again, you know, I grew up with this dread of other people's opinions. And, you know, it's a never-ending, you never stop worrying about it once you start. And I know people in my small town to this day are still worried about maintaining some particular position in this intricate sort of hive-like structure.
Now, the book ends fascinatingly, not in fact on the Master Butcher's singing club, but on a woman who's known as Step and a Half. She has been called Minnie by another character, but Step and a Half because she walks so quickly, her stride. And the book falls into, for its conclusion, the life of a Native American woman who may very well have been one of those at Wounded Knee. Did I imagine this correctly?
You did.
Oh, good.
Yes. And I thought so much about that particular piece of oral history, and I tried to recreate this woman as someone who walked away from Wounded Knee and never stopped walking her entire life, couldn't stop walking.
But she seems to be the connective spirit. People in the town don't call her an Indian or a Native American. They more or less treat her just as a homeless wanderer. She collects things. And she seems to be the principal that's gathering the book together, its oddments, its bits of junk. Eventually she's going to open a notions shop, which is fabulous. But she seems to be the spirit of the missing connectiveness, almost as if her shop is the town's archive. What these other people are jettisoning, abandoning, and casting off, she's saving. And
yes,
it's as if she is the spirit, the missing spirit of the town.
Exactly. The people in the town believe that their new things, the things they make, the things they cherish, the things they display, tell their stories. But she knows the truth, and that is, the truth is that their junk tells the stories, their cast-offs, the things that they leave behind, the things that they don't value, tell their stories. And she is the repository of their truth and their stories. And by the end, she's also the person who solves the identity, the mystery of Delphine's identity.
I've been speaking with Louise Erdrich, author, most recently, of The Master Butcher's Singing Club, published as are all her books by HarperCollins. Thank you, Louise, for joining me.
Thank you. I love talking to you. I see so many new things in this book. Thank you.
You can read an excerpt.
So appreciate.
Oh, thank you, Louise. You can read an excerpt from the Master Butcher's Singing Club on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineers have been Ray Guarna at KCRW and Manoli Wetherill at the NPR studio in Manhattan. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse.